Alaskans know about the 7.9 earthquake that shook the state January 23rd, but just how did the scientists figure out the location of that quake, as they do for tremors around the world? What is the process for sharing that information, and should a major disaster strike, how would the federal government step in to help Alaskans recover? Learn more on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
The 7.9 quake on January 23rd shook up Alaskans in the middle of the night, caused many to rush to higher ground, but thankfully caused no significant damage and did not generate a destructive tsunami. Still, it reminded us that the ground beneath our feet is not stable and the water around us can be more fluid than we would like. We'll discuss how scientists can pinpoint an earthquake, how they predict tsunamis, how the buoys and sensors work to help warn us, how that information is shared, and what the federal government can do to help if disaster strikes. Joining me today on Talk of Alaska, we have Ken McPherson from the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. He's in the studio here in Anchorage, and Mike O'Hare, Regional 10 Administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is on the phone joining us from Salem, Oregon, where he is for a regional meeting. Thank you for calling in, Mike.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay. Let's start with how the Earth moved January 23rd. I read a column by Ned Rozelle, a science writer at the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Ned said that quake did not generate a massive wave because, and I'm going to quote him, it did not shove the seafloor toward the sky. It was more like two freight trains passing too close, grinding past one another. So I guess it was a slide, not an uplift. Ken, you're the geologist, seismologist. What happened?
Sure. I thought Ned's column was really great, and he really did an expert job of describing what happened that morning. But before I talk about how the Earth moved on January 23rd, I'd just like to take a step back and talk about the major geologic structure that kind of drives how the earthquakes and seismic activity occur in South Central Alaska. It's something, a process called subduction, and it's really like a global scale collision where the Pacific tectonic plate is moving at about 6 centimeters towards the Alaskan block of the North American tectonic plate.
And for people who don't do metric, 6 centimeters is a quarter inch?
6 centimeters would be about 2.5, 3 inches.
Okay, shows what I know about metric.
Yeah, so it's not moving very quickly on human scales. You can't see it move, but on a geologic scale, the Pacific plate is actually moving quite rapidly towards Alaska. And these two tectonic plates collide. Now, the Pacific Oceanic Plate is primarily composed of very iron-rich, dense rocks, where Alaska is composed of more silica-rich, less dense rocks. So if I take two big blocks and I cram them together, and one's heavier and denser than the other, what's going to happen? Well, the denser stuff is going to sink, and it's going to sink or subduct below Alaska, and this is a process known as subduction. And so where those two plates meet, South Central Alaska and well out into the Aleutians, is the subduction zone interface, and that's where most of the large earthquakes in Alaska occur. And of course, the archetypical example is all Alaskans know about the massive 1964 9.2 earthquake, which was the second biggest earthquake ever recorded by seismologists in the instrumental age. So that's what really drives the tectonics and the earthquakes in Alaska. But that's not what happened on January 23rd. So that earthquake did not occur on the subduction zone, but a little bit to the south of that. And so at 12:31 a.m. on January 23rd.
A time you remember well because you were working, right?
I was working at that time, and I'll never forget it. But the Pacific plate started to rupture in what's called a strike slip fault. And so a subduction earthquake, most of the motion is vertical, and that moves the entire water column and very efficiently generates a tsunami. But with a strike-slip earthquake, the motion is side to side, and it's not very efficient at moving the water column and causing a tsunami. And so that was the good news that night, that this earthquake was not in the subduction zone, but it was still a massive event. So just to give you an idea of how big the fault was that moved, it was about 200 kilometers long.
Okay, 120 miles or so.
120 miles. So straight line distance, that's from about Anchorage to Homer. So that's the size of the fault that ruptured or kind of unzipped on the morning of the 23rd. And that put a lot of seismic energy into the ground and, of course, got our attention very quickly at the Tsunami Warning Center.
Before I go to a question, I'll remind people this is Talk of Alaska. The call-in number 1-800-478-8255. From Anchorage, it's 550-8422. We're talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. Ken, I'm going to ask the layperson's question. When you look at fault lines that are on the surface, you can see many times the fault line, either satellite images, LIDAR, laser images. If you could look at the ocean floor, would you see this fault line? Is there something visible?
There are fault traces that we call them that are visible on the surface. If you look at the ocean floor, seismologists are still working to tease out exactly what fault this particular earthquake is on. But it's likely it has a surface expression that you can see on the ocean floor. And in the coming months and years, there'll be a lot of research into that, determining which fault it was actually on. But just from the seismic waves alone, we do know that it was about a 200 kilometer long fault, and it was roughly east-west orientation. And another interesting thing about this quake is the rupture began in the middle of the fault. So the fault started to move in the middle, and the rupture or the rip, the tear in the earth, it went to the west 100 kilometers, and it also propagated to the east 100 kilometers. So sort of like a double zipper that unzips in two different directions simultaneously. Seismologists refer to this as a bilateral rupture. So it was quite a complex faulting or rupture process on that morning.
So sensors pick this up, right? Which sensors, how does that work? How many of them, and how do you get the data in Palmer?
Oh, that's a great question. So I was sitting at my desk on January 23rd at 12:30, and we got a short period alarm. And that's quite common at the center.
Is this flashing lights and bells and whistles?
It's not quite that dramatic. It's just a voice over a speaker, and it literally announces short period alarm. And usually not a big deal. We get about one of these an hour on average at the center. And so myself and David Hale, the senior watchstander at that time, we stood up and walked into operations to examine this signal. And a short period alarm just means that one station has picked up an oscillatory motion, and it could be a seismic wave. But the interesting thing, before we reached the operations center, the phone started to ring. And so immediately we knew that someone had felt this earthquake.
And these are just members of the public calling in.
Yeah, someone felt the shaking from the earthquake, and so they called in. By the time we sat down at our workstations, the computer had solved and had a location for the earthquake. And so how that works is, once the fault ruptures, it sends seismic energy into the earth. And those are essentially long period sound waves that travel at high velocities through the earth. And we have sensors on Kodiak Island, seismometers, and they were the first two to detect the signal. One at Old Harbor and the other at Kodiak City. And so that's what alarmed and told us something was going on. And about a minute and a half after that rupture began at 12:31, the computer had solved and it knew roughly where this earthquake was. And so how do we do that? It's a mathematical process called inversion of travel time data.
Oh, yeah. I just studied that at breakfast.
Yeah. It sounds very, very complicated. But all it really means is that we guess, okay? We guess in a sophisticated way, but we really guess. Because all we know is what time did the seismic wave arrive at particular stations, and we also have an understanding of the speeds at which seismic waves move through the Earth. So we take these observations of the arrival time of the waves, and we just guess, and we say, well, what if the earthquake was at point X? Does that fit our observations? Well, from the first guess, it's probably not going to fit. And so we adjust the location of the earthquake, and then we recompute and say, well, does that fit the arrival times better? And of course, the computer can do this very quickly and efficiently. And after about a minute and a half of doing this guesswork, we had a pretty robust, accurate location for where the quake was.
So for that minute and a half, while the computer's figuring out the exact location, you're getting calls from people around Alaska saying, hey, I just felt an earthquake. So it's affirmation that the computer's got it right.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there are seismic sensors in the ground, but also humans are seismic sensors that are feeling the ground motions and calling in saying something's going on here.
Okay, so let's talk about humans for a minute with Mike O'Hare, Region 10 Administrator for Federal Emergency Management Administration. Mike, FEMA's job, I know, is to help prepare the country for natural disasters and then help respond. But when an alert of a 7.9 earthquake goes out or a possible tsunami, what does FERC initially do, even before there's any reports of damage or no damage? I assume you must have a center that kind of kicks into gear.
Sure. Thanks, Larry. And thanks for having me on. And Ken, great to hear you. And that was a wonderful description of what transpires. So when that tsunami alert goes out, and it does go out from Ken's operation to the state of Alaska's Emergency Operations Center, and also to relays out to the FEMA Region 10 Operations Center, that an earthquake of a certain magnitude has occurred, and Ken's group puts together this through this algorithm a model of potential warning of a potential tsunami in certain communities. When that alert goes off, the state of Alaska's Emergency Operations Center activates, kicks in. We at FEMA Region 10 at our operations center, I got woken up at that hour that there was a situation going on, and my job is to activate the our regional operations center here to support the state of Alaska, so not in case something happens. So of course we're all alerted to what's happening. The state of Alaska then calls those communities in harm's way based upon the predictive model the Ken's team puts out, and calls them, sends out a blast call that there's a tsunami warning for these areas. And then as their emergency operations center is activated, they literally call to confirm those communities, and they have those phone numbers. Did you receive the message? It is a valid warning, and the local community leaders hit that tsunami warning siren that we see in some of those communities. And then from there, the local communities that are very familiar with the tsunami drills and tsunami events take the warning, the big blast of and the police. First responders, emergency managers, you saw the videos on the internet of Kodiak and Dutch Harbor to evacuate and get to high ground, and then it's up to the community citizens to take that, heed that message, and prepare to evacuate and get to high ground. So that's kind of how that works.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Hey, a pretty structured system. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. The call-in number, 1-800-478-8255, from Anchorage, 550-8422. We have a caller on the air Stu from Anchorage.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question, cyclical earthquakes. I remember listening to other earthquake specialists talk, and one suggested there was approximately a 60-year cycle for large earthquakes in South Central. And I just wanted to see if there's a comment on that. And also, you know, we had the Inishkin earthquake, in January 2 years ago, and that definitely got me out of my house and a lot of other people. Is there a seasonal aspect to earthquakes? Right, we had Good Friday in March, Inishkin, January. We just had another one in January. Is there a seasonal aspect to earthquakes? Do they occur in winter months?
I don't know, but I bet Ken has an answer here. Ken?
Yeah, it is striking that the Inishkin quake was January 24th, so almost 2 years to the day prior to the Kodiak earthquake of last month. And so that is striking, but I think often what happens is the human brain is very good at finding patterns, and sometimes it'll impose patterns where none actually exist. And so it's very easy to, you know, see these patterns in nature, even though they're not actually there. But it is true that it's an active area of research that people look for things like seasonality and earthquake cycles. And there's some recent work, looking at do lunar phases affect seismicity and that kind of thing. But definitely, there a lot more work needs to be done before we can identify a lot of these cycles. Now, on a longer tectonic time scale, we can look at recurrence intervals, and we can see going back in history by using paleoseismic techniques that there in some areas there's been great earthquakes around every 500 years and that kind of thing. And that seems to be the general recurrence interval for earthquakes such as the 1964. But in general, it's very dangerous to, kind of predict or forecast earthquakes based on a particular cycle like that. And that may just be that, earthquakes are inherently unpredictable, that they're just a random event, or it could be that we just don't know enough yet. And, as the science progresses, we'll start to pin down some of those cycles. But it's a very interesting topic.
So in terms of, you mentioned it's difficult. What's the hardest part in pinpointing the exact location of a quake and, that possible damage zone? Is there going to be a tsunami or not? What factors go into telling us there's a tsunami alert? So I guess there's probably three questions in there.
Right. Pinpointing the quake, as I explained earlier, using this inversion of travel time or guessing technique, that's maybe the easiest part, and we can do that very rapidly. Determining the size of the earthquake or the earthquake magnitude, that can be much trickier, particularly for large earthquakes. Now, a lot of times you'll hear the media report there was a 7.9 on the Richter scale earthquake, and they're citing a particular magnitude scale. Now, if it was that big, it probably didn't measure on the Richter scale because the Richter scale isn't good at measuring large earthquakes. This is a problem in seismology that's called magnitude saturation. And I think the easiest way to think about it is if we imagine an earthquake fault like a guitar string. If it's a small earthquake, it's a very short fault or a short guitar string. And if I pluck that string, it's mostly high frequency energy. But a large earthquake is like a very long guitar string. And if I pluck that string, there's a lot of long period or low frequency energy. And so it takes a long time for that long period energy to arrive at a seismic station. And so if I use Richter scale and I just measure a short piece of the seismic wave that's arriving at the station, I'm going to miss that long period signal. And so Richter scale might say that 7.9 is actually a 6.2, and it's not a very good measure. And so usually the magnitude scale that we use for large earthquakes is called the moment magnitude, which is a more direct observation of the earthquake energy. And so we've gotten really good at using a modified version of that at the National Tsunami Warning Center. And so using that modified moment magnitude scale, we were able to get a good magnitude in about 3 minutes.
Which is pretty quick. Mike, speaking of time and response, let me ask about FEMA. So a lot of science, a lot of variables. I assume when an alert goes out, be it a quake or tsunami, FERC must measure its response against the likelihood of it being a significantly damaging event. Otherwise, you guys would be moving constantly.
Yeah, absolutely, Larry. And so understanding that any earthquake over a certain magnitude could potentially threaten communities in Alaska or in our region greatly, we need to government response need to be prepared to activate and support the state and the local communities. But I think what we really need to do is to, we need to relook, reframe, and refocus the expectations of the government on that response and recovery, and refocus that down to community resilience. I mean, if you look at the videos that were out there, the Kodiak community that was at the city of Kodiak that was evacuating, they've been through this before. They know the threats that are befalling upon them and what they need to do when they hear those sirens or when they feel that earthquake.
They take it seriously.
Absolutely. And so that is a more resilient community than a lot of communities in the nation. And so what we need to refocus is, hey, don't rely on the government to come help you. You need to understand the threats in your community and what you can do to better prepare yourself to take care of yourselves, because it's going to be a long time before the state or federal government can come in and assist. So what can you do for your family? What can you do for your neighbors? And have those conversations, those frank, very simple conversations about, hey, what would you do in a situation like that and how to better prepare yourself for it?
Okay, that's good advice. We've got a caller, Sherry from Seward.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about understanding, or how long did it take for the warning center to understand this was a slip strike quake rather than a vertical movement. We all did quite a bit of moving down here in Seward, and that's good. I mean, better to be safe than sorry, but I'm on a little bit of a higher ground, and had I understood a strike slip phenomena, I might have just stayed put.
That's okay. Such a great question. We actually knew probably about 20 minutes after the origin time of the earthquake that this was a strike slip. And even earlier than that, just from looking at the earthquake location, we could see that this isn't on the subduction zone where the large earthquakes with a lot of vertical motion occur, but was south of that inside the Pacific plate. And just based on that, we had a good idea that, you know, this could well be a strike slip and was probably not a vertical type of event. So just based on that location, I know that I personally was breathing a little easier when I saw that. About 20 minutes after that, we had confirmation from the United States Geological Survey that this was indeed a strike slip event. And, you know, my heart rate started to go down even more after that.
And once you figure that out, then you send that information out to news media, FEMA, state officials, communities?
We don't communicate those details about the earthquake mechanism, like mm-hmm. how the fault moved, because our procedures are based solely on the earthquake location and the magnitude, and then later on our ocean observations. So with an earthquake that big, even though that we're feeling better that it's a strike slip event, we still have to assume that there's a tsunami out there just based on the magnitude. And until we get observations from tide stations and also NOAA's DART, which that's another acronym, that's the Deep Ocean Reporting and Assessment of Tsunamis, we can actually observe the wave. And once we see the wave and we can refine our forecasts and we can get a much better estimate on how big the tsunami waves are going to be when they reach population centers, then we can start to think about downgrading the warning. But we won't downgrade the warning just based on the earthquake mechanism.
Well, that kind of gets to Mike's point from FEMA's people need to take it seriously and be prepared. Before I get back to a FEMA question, we've got a caller, Joseph from Anchorage.
Well, I thank you for taking the call, and this is a very important subject. But my question comes from what a friend had exposed to me on the internet, the number of videos and information about a theory that the Earth is expanding. And I find this very difficult to believe. But when you look at all of the continents, you don't need a Pangea for everything to fit together. We know how South America tucks up into Africa. And we can all admit, well, the Atlantic Ocean never existed. But at the time of the alleged Pangea, all of the continents also connect in the Pacific. I realize this topic may be a distraction this morning, and I would like to discuss this with your guest.
Okay, maybe Ken can.
It's really confused me all these years.
Maybe Ken can just give us a short answer on that, and then we can move on to the next caller.
Sure. That's really interesting. But to be honest, as a seismologist, I think on timescales of minutes, and where my geologist friends who look at, you know, long-term tectonics look at millions, if not billions of years. So I have to confess that you're a little outside my area of expertise there, and I'm not really sure about that.
Okay. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. Mike O'Hare from FEMA, as we talk about people taking the warning seriously until there's more information, until there's an all clear, until there's observations. In addition to responding, you had talked about FEMA works on preparedness. What advice do you have for Alaskans? What does FEMA do to help us better prepare?
Yeah, thanks, Larry, for the question. The FEMA lead administrator, the head administrator, Brock Long, and I, we've got three priorities, is to facilitate a culture of preparedness around the nation, ready the nation for a catastrophic disaster, and then also reduce the complexities of any small grants that FEMA can provide for individuals and communities. But for the listeners, I think, you know, pretty simple what to do is to, like I said before, is to talk and have that conversation and embrace the idea that every person has the ability and the obligation to make a difference in a crisis. Not just stand around and wait around, but help people. Be that help until help arrives. And then do something, you know, large or small, to prepare, but do something. Take a CPR class. Look at your preparedness kit. If you have you should have a home preparedness kit to be able to last for several days before help arrives, to be on your own. Also, look at your insurance coverages. The best way to resilience, whether it be an earthquake or a fire or a flood or a tsunami, is to also look at your insurance to see what's covered and not covered, because these government programs aren't designed to make somebody whole, to rebuild their house. These are just very small resources that the state and federal government have to be able to get somebody at least up on a knee in a shelter for a period of time, or a temporary house for a period of time until they can get their life back together again. And that, you know, like I said, the reliance on government for support is not the key to resilience.
Good advice.
It is through the individual. So.
Okay. Good of advice. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking earthquakes and tsunamis with Mike O'Hare, Region 10 Administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and Ken McPherson from the Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. Talk of Alaska continues.
Today's program is underwritten in part by...
Support comes from Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska, Earthquakes and Tsunamis. We have Alan on the phone from Anchorage.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure, hear you great, Alan.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. It was a really interesting topic. I just wanted to comment quickly about an app. One of my favorite apps on my phone is called Quake Feed. That's Quake, F-E-E-D, and it's sourced from the United States Geological Survey. And I get notifications from it all day about all the different earthquakes that are happening around the world, and I just thought it was a really neat app. And like when we got the earthquake a couple weeks back, you know, it woke me up, and I had the notification from the app just a couple minutes after the earthquake happened, and I just wanted to mention it. And that's all. I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Ken, let me ask, how many centers are there around the nation similar to the warning center in Palmer?
Well, the U.S. has two tsunami warning centers, and the history of how those centers came into existence is interesting because it really centers around Alaska. So the two centers are the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii and, of course, the National Center in Palmer, Alaska. But it all rotates around Alaska. So if we go back to...
Well, often that's the way we see things here.
It is. And, you know, as by far the most actively, seismically active state in the Union, it makes sense. But if we go back to 1946, there was a huge earthquake in the Aleutians close to Unimak Island. And it actually destroyed the Coast Guard lighthouse, the resultant tsunami, there at Scotch Cap. So that was a terrible tragedy. But the tragedy of that day continued because a large ocean-crossing tsunami went out into the Pacific and actually arrived in Hawaii several hours later without warning and resulted in over 100 casualties in Hilo. And it was after that tragic event that the U.S. government realized that it needed some kind of tsunami warning capability. And so in the early 50s, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center was founded in Hawaii. And so if we fast forward to 1964, all Alaskans know what happened on Good Friday and the terrible tsunami damage at Valdez, for example. And as a result of that event, the National Center was founded in Palmer, Alaska. So those are the two U.S. Tsunami Warning Centers. And then in addition to that, there are many seismic observatories around the U.S. Of course, the Alaska Earthquake Center up at UAF Fairbanks is responsible for being the definitive cataloger of seismicity in Alaska. And there are many regional seismic centers around the nation. And then, of course, the National Earthquake Information Center compiles a catalog of global seismicity.
Okay. We have, let's go to a couple calls. We've got some stacked up. Roger from White Mountain.
Good morning.
Hi, Roger. What's your question?
Since the Earth's crust is made up of solid matter, do earthquakes happen more on land than, say, in the ocean, or does that make any difference? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
To your
Thank response. You.
Thank you.
Ken.
Yeah, great question. That's right. The Earth's crust, which is on average about 30 kilometers thick, that's the hard, rocky portion of the Earth that we live on. It's hard and brittle, and it can break in a brittle fashion, and that's what we call an earthquake. But in general, we can have them on land, and just as easily we can have them on the oceanic crust, just like what we had on the January 23rd. Of course, the most earthquakes occur at those tectonic plate interfaces that we were talking about earlier, like the trench off the Aleutians where the Pacific plate is subducting underneath Alaska. That's where the majority of earthquakes occur, and that trench is often under the water. So it really doesn't make any difference whether it's on land or under the water. It's that brittle composition of the crust that you talked about, that solid matter that those rocks can break and fracture and rupture and cause an earthquake.
Okay, thanks. Before I get back on some FEMA questions, let's take another call. Lauren from Anchorage.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. When I was listening to the news on CNN, they were saying there was a wave measured out at a buoy at 38 feet. And I was just curious if the wave was measured that high back at the buoy out in the ocean, why we did not get such a big tsunami.
I'm going to guess Ken's got a good answer for us on that one. Ken?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought up that buoy measurement. CNN unfortunately picked that up, and it was, 30 feet or a 10-meter blip at that buoy. And so one thing to point out about those dart buoys is they measured a tsunami in the deep ocean. And in the deep ocean, the tsunami amplitude or the height of the tsunami wave is usually very small. Even a big tsunami in the open ocean might only measure a few centimeters or a few inches. But when that wave comes ashore, it grows. As the wave slows down, as it approaches the coastline, the amplitude or the height of the wave grows. So if it really had been measured at 10 meters in the open ocean, we're talking, one of the most gigantic waves in history. It would have had to been maybe an asteroid impact that caused a wave that big. So really what we saw that day with that blip was just noise in the data. It was just an error in measurement. And people that are trained in tsunami science, could look at that measurement and tell immediately that it was just an erroneous value and it was discounted or figured out. But unfortunately, CNN saw it and it seemed very dramatic. And so they reported that as an actual wave, but it absolutely was not.
False reading.
False reading.
Okay. Let's shift back to FEMA for just a question. Mike, you talk about Alaskans or anyone around the country shouldn't expect FEMA and the federal government to come in and make everything whole, make everything perfect again. But in terms of if we had a major disaster in Alaska, what are a couple of the most important or most meaningful programs that FEMA does offer or would offer?
Sure. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for the question. So FEMA has programs to assist individuals and also to assist individuals that have had lost, personal belongings. Their homes have been damaged or destroyed. They don't have any insurance. It may cover their deductible if they do have insurance.
And these are grant programs.
These are grant programs, yes, but they're very minimal grant programs, Larry. I mean, we're talking about on average, maybe $3,000. So if your house was totally destroyed, maybe you get more with that. But it's again only designed truly to get an individual back up on step and hopefully get them on track to some sort of normalcy. And then also what we call public assistance or critical infrastructure damage, so roads, bridges, those types of things to assist communities and states to help repair that critical infrastructure as well. So those are the programs that we have available. Again, they're not make-whole programs, but they're designed to assist individuals and communities to get on the road to recovery.
And if there were a major disaster, FEMA would set up temporary offices, take applications, that kind of stuff.
Thanks. Yeah. So again, supporting the state of Alaska in this case, we would our job primarily is to coordinate every federal resource for life safety response and recovery mission to support the state, to support their citizens.
Okay, thank you. This is Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. From Anchorage, 550-8422. We have Dick on the line from Utah, if I read this correctly.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
I have a question for you. I've visited Alaska numerous times, and I've seen these devices on top of poles, like in Seward at the Harbor Master and on Nash Road. They look like inverted beehive or old beehives sitting on poles. Is that part of the tsunami system, or are you aware of it?
I've seen them too. Ken, are those speakers?
Not positive, but that sounds like that could be a speaker associated with the tsunami siren.
Maybe for
I can answer that.
Okay, yeah, Mike. Mike can tell us what
those are. Those are alert and warning sirens. Those are either just the original kind of big noise sirens, or the more advanced ones are the big, what we call the big voice sirens that were paid for and installed with from Homeland Security grants to the communities for alert and warning. Just exactly what that was for. Those are the big warnings that either they get the big noise, the big siren, or the big voice to either to do something or not to do something. So, yep.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Let me ask, as long as I got you, Mike, are there restrictions? Are there things that FEMA cannot do?
Yeah, thanks. Great question.
Yeah, I assume there are.
Again, thanks. So they're not designed to make you whole. They're, like I said, they're micro grants that can provide a limited assistance to address immediate needs. So sheltering, a temporary shelter or home. The primary focus is going to be stabilizing your situation so that you can have someplace safe, sanitary, and secure to begin your recovery. Insurance is absolutely going to be your best option for resilience. It's designed to do that. What can we do as the government to assist? We're going to stabilize the situation, but not make you whole.
Okay, thanks. Ken, let's go back to tsunami for a minute. What does a tsunami alert mean? Does it mean possible, probable, certain?
Well, there are several different layers or levels of tsunami product that the NTWC puts out there. And the lowest level is called a tsunami information statement. And so you might get this and it just says, well, there's been an earthquake and you might have felt shaking, but there's no tsunami impending. The earthquake wasn't large enough to generate a tsunami. And this kind of product, it irritates people sometimes because they think, well, why are you sending a tsunami information statement about no tsunami? But the thinking is, if you're on the coastline, you might feel the shaking from an earthquake. And if you feel that shaking, you might think, well, I need to evacuate inland. And maybe you're having a good time and you're fighting a salmon or something. But if you get a tsunami information statement and it says, there's no danger, you can stay put, you can keep fighting that salmon, and there's no need to evacuate. So that's the thinking there. The next level is an advisory. Now, an advisory says that there is a tsunami generated, and there could be a wave that arrives, but it's not going to be a large inundating wave that would require an evacuation inland. Because when we tell people to evacuate, you need to go at least a mile inland. So an advisory says no need to evacuate, but you probably don't want to go swimming or stay at a boat dock.
Pay attention.
Yeah, pay attention, exactly. And, get away from the water's edge, but no need to evacuate. And then, of course, the level above that is a warning. And that just says that there's a large wave coming and it could be inundating. So you need to evacuate at least a mile inland and upslope if possible. And another point I'd like to make about that is a tsunami wave is very complicated wave train. And so often the first wave to arrive is not the biggest, and it usually won't be a single wave arrival. There could be a series of waves. So if you do evacuate, it's very important to remain in your safe location until emergency managers tell you it's okay to return to the coastline, because there could be significant tsunami waves hours or maybe even a day after the initial wave arrival.
So don't get complacent. We've got a few calls stacked up. Shelley from Anchorage, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention one thing, and then I had a question. When I first felt the earthquake, I was sitting on kind of the chaise end of a couch, and for at least about 15 seconds, I felt a very low trembling. And my house wasn't shaking at all like it normally does for that, it was a pretty extended period of time. And my husband was in the kitchen. I asked him if he felt anything. He didn't feel anything at all. And then the house started shaking after I got up and went into the kitchen. So it seemed like a long time that trembling was occurring, which I felt through the cushions before there was shaking, which was pretty unusual. Then I did, when I was sitting on the couch, I did have, afterwards, I had a flash on my phone that said, go to high ground, and that is in Anchorage. And my husband didn't get that same flash on his phone, and he indicated that because of our location in Anchorage up Cook Inlet, and because Cook Inlet doesn't have enough water generally to transmit that tsunami into Anchorage, that we didn't need to heed that warning. And so there was kind of a dichotomy between what he was saying and the flash that I got on the phone. And I don't know if everybody got that flash, but it only flashed for a second and then disappeared.
Yeah, a lot of us
couldn't pick it up again.
A lot of us got it. Let's have Ken briefly answer about the tsunami risk all the way up Cook Inlet. Ken Nickarm, and then we can take a couple more calls.
Yeah, we got a lot of calls from Anchorage citizens, you know, asking if they should evacuate. In general, Anchorage is safe, just like you said, because of its position in Cook Inlet. That water is very shallow, and so if a tsunami wave enters the inlet, because it slows down in response to the shallow water, and consequently it attenuates or it dies out rapidly before much energy can get all the way up to Anchorage. So there could be a situation where Anchorage was affected, but it's very unlikely, and it would probably require a large earthquake in the inlet. So in general, Anchorage is pretty safe from tsunami. And I really appreciate your comments about the ground motions you felt. That's very interesting. You know, the shaking is so complex. There are lots of different phases, different types of waves. And because of your great distance from the earthquake source, a lot of the high frequency energy was attenuated out. So what you felt was a very long period ground roll. And so that's very interesting stuff. Thanks for commenting on that.
Thank you. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
This is Larry Pursley, Talk of Alaska, Tsunamis and Earthquakes. We have an email from Alex who asked if we could mention that the science and the public can participate in the reporting science by going to a USGS site, Did You Feel It form, and fill that out. And this helps you, the U.S. Geological Survey generate earthquake maps, understand how locals experience it. Ken, are you familiar with that form?
Yeah, thanks so much for mentioning that. It's such a great data source. And earlier we were talking about seismic sensors, and we have seismometers and holes in the ground, but people are seismic sensors too. They're walking around. And so if you feel shaking, yeah, I urge you to go to that USGS website, and you can just Google, Did You Feel It? And there's a very short form there that you can fill out. Just takes a few seconds to do that. And seismologists will actually use that data to understand ground motions in response to earthquakes. And it's very useful data for seismic research.
Public can help with that. We have Mindy from Petersburg.
Good morning. Thanks for this great topic.
Sure. Thank you.
I was wondering if you know of any programs out there, grant money for small communities to obtain emergency radios, like the hand crank kind where you don't need electricity or batteries. Do you know of anything like that communities can apply for?
We'll ask Mike, and I'll just... Mike O'Hare from FEMA. Are there those funds?
Yeah, thanks. Great question. What I would do, Mindy, I would give the city and borough of Juneau a call, Tom Matisse. He's the emergency manager there. He has the opportunity to look at some grant opportunities, just some small grant opportunities for either some radios. There's also, you may want to get a hold of the Red Cross. Their website. They may have some weather radios to assist you there.
Okay, thank you. We have Bob from Sitka on the line.
Yes, good morning. I was interested about archaeological sites. Actually, I was in Japan on March 11 during the earthquake and tsunami over there.
I'm glad you're still with us.
And yeah, it was quite an a life-changing experience for me. But my question is about in Japan they had a number of markers where in ancient times tsunamis came, and they said not to build below these markers, and during that tsunami the wave reached those markers, and so in Alaska we have similar archaeological places where tsunamis have hit, and so I think it's important that we take note of those ancient markers so that we can prepare ourselves in the future for those.
Well, basically, learn from history. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. And those, I've seen some markers. Ken, does your office put those up, or does up to the communities put them up?
I believe that's mostly the communities as part of the Tsunami Ready program.
Okay.
So there are markers and also evacuation routes that are clearly marked in those Tsunami Ready communities. But definitely using that historical and prehistoric data, I think, can be very useful.
And that gets to Mike's point of communities being prepared and getting people to take it seriously and have information. We have Rudy from Ketchikan.
Yes, I was curious. One of your guests keeps mentioning insurance, and from what I understand, and what I believe my insurance agent told me this, was that since 1964, earthquake insurance in Alaska is either unavailable or prohibitive. Does anybody know anything about that?
Mike, do you have any sense on insurance?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. I did mention insurance is the key, and it is available in Alaska. It may be expensive, and so one of our missions is to work with the state, to work with the state insurance commissioners to see how we can get a better insurance market out there. People don't take advantage of the insurance market. It may be cost prohibitive. But I got to tell you, in the long run, when you lose your entire house, it's the best thing in the whole wide world, best money ever spent.
Right. None of us like paying for insurance for anything until we need it. It's actually
absolutely
scary to think how much we've paid for insurance probably over the years, and some of us are fortunate. We have a question came in by email from Tom asking about people who evacuated when the alerts went out based on. So his question is, isn't anyone at 100 feet above sea level okay from a distant quake? Let me ask Ken, can you pinpoint and say, I'm about 100 feet, I'm fine, or is it not that precise?
Generally, we tell people a mile inland or 100 feet
up, elevation.
100 feet in elevation, and that's a general rule of thumb that should keep you straight. Now, a lot of the tsunami-ready communities have maps that show the maximum inundation line that's possible or probable, and so you can always check those maps. But as a rule of thumb, a mile inland or 100 feet upslope.
Even if that mile is flat?
That gets trickier.
Right. And someone online said, well, gee, what if I'm 5 miles inland, but I'm right on a river.
Yeah, exactly. And the 2011 Japan event that someone mentioned is a good example of that. In some of the flat plains areas, the wave went very far inland. And so the best that you can do is a mile inland and 100 feet up. So
if the terrain allows it, everyone may not have that option.
Yeah, further up you can get and the further inland, the better.
Okay, we have a couple minutes left. We have Lee from Anchorage.
Hi.
Hi.
I was in Unalaska Dutch Harbor for the January 23rd event, And my question has to do with the best source of information during that waiting time after the alarms, the automatic alarms have gone off, people have evacuated, we're on higher ground, the public safety people are kind of around, but not, there's no information, especially in areas where everybody immediately starts to think of the internet, but there's not good information about what's happening in real time. And a lot of people, my phone didn't work, of course, out there. So people were accessing Facebook and CNN. But of course, as we've heard, that's not a reliable source of good information about what is happening as we're just waiting for the possible tsunami to arrive. So what's the best source of good?
That's a good question. We've got about a minute and a half left, so we'll split that. Yep. And Mike, you want to take the first 45 seconds?
Sure do. So when in doubt, I would you wait for the all clear. And listen to the local emergency management.
Okay, and Ken?
I would just amplify that. The Tsunami Warning Center, we will send you information about the forecast, but it's really up to the local emergency manager, when to sound the all clear and go back. You can get messages directly from the National Tsunami Warning Center. If you go to tsunami.gov, there's information on there about how to subscribe for text messages, text message alerts, and we also pump our products to Twitter and Facebook. But as Mike said, emergency managers are the ones you want to be listening to for sure.
And the tsunami.gov can get you the information. But of course, we're so dependent that assumes internet stays up and electricity stays up.
Exactly. That can be tricky.
Right. So it's as Mike explained from FEMA, have a plan, be prepared. As you explained, Ken, listen to your locals, check the web, and hopefully we're all ready for the next one. This was Talk of Alaska, talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. Our guests today were Ken McPherson of the U.S. Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer and Mike O'Hare, Region 10 Administrator from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which covers Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho. Our engineer was Dave Waldron. Thank you to our guests, and thank you to the callers. This was Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.